The Science Behind Alien Encounters with Dr. Robert Farrell. That's up next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Our special guest, Dr. Robert Farrell, with us, received his Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from Ohio State University, his MBA from Western New England College, his Doctorate of Engineering from the University of Massachusetts. For nearly 20 years, Dr. Farrell worked in the plastics industry. And then about 16 years ago, he gave up his position as a vice president to become a professor at Penn State University, where he helped start a plastics engineering technology program. Recently retired from Penn State as associate professor emeritus. For most of his life, Dr. Farrell has been interested in ufology. For more than 10 years, he began doing serious research for his novel Alien Log. Now, this book is unique that it offers readers a nuts and bolts approach encompassing many aspects of ufology. And then he came out with Alien Log 2 and 3 and also The Science Behind Noah's Flood. And the one we're talking about tonight, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. And Robert, is our math right? Has it been 9 years since you've been on the program?
Yes, that's right. 2012 was the last time I was on.
My gosh, how have you been?
I've been doing fine, thank you. I have to say, I didn't recently retire. When I think back, it's been longer than that. It's about 17 years ago I retired.
My God, they need to update your bio for me.
I was thinking as you were reading it. Actually, I've been involved in ufology, I guess, for 25 years at least.
What came first, ufology or all the other things that you've done in your career?
Well, of course, I have to say, from a child, I was always curious about the heavens and UFOs. So I guess you could say that came first. But I really didn't dedicate a lot of time to it until probably 25, 30 years ago. I started really getting serious about it. And if you in my book, I kind of focus in on the gravitational field propulsion, and because I think that's actually a key thing in this whole discussion. But anyway, after I retired, my plan was to learn more about physics and how you could actually produce gravity. But somehow I felt compelled that, no, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to try and convince people who are skeptical about this whole subject matter, or people who just during their everyday life don't even think about UFOs. But I need to kind of prepare them, because I felt that within my lifetime there's going to be a disclosure. And people had to be prepared for that, so it's not a sudden shock. And so when I finally did retire, I was going to write a book on UFOs, but then I thought, you know, the people that I need to reach with my message would never pick up a book on UFOs. So I thought, well, I'll bury the information into science fiction novels. So my very first book was Alien Log. And even though it's science fiction, because the story is fiction, the dialogue actually brings out the information that I would have put into my UFO book. And so, by the way, I just last week actually launched Alien Log number 4, the Antarctica.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And this one, The Science Behind Alien Encounters, is the second edition, isn't it?
That's right. You know, actually, the first edition was in 2012. And so all during this period of time, a lot has happened. You know, science is moving along, and new discoveries and various things have occurred that I thought, well, it's time to actually update the book. And not only that, but in 2017, I attended a UFO conference back in November of 2017. It was in Nevada, and Jaime Masson was there, and he brought out for the first time into the American public this discovery of the bodies down in Peru. And I really became fascinated about that when he started talking about bodies that were tridactyl. And I, as you may know, I also followed Zachariah Sitchin and the Sumerian, and information about the Sumerians.
Right.
And the number 12 was very important in their culture, and I often wondered, why would that be? Because, you know, I hold up my hands, I got 10 digits, why wouldn't 10 be? So when Jaime was making his presentation, and these bodies were both two different species, were both tridactyl, in other words, they had 12 digits, you know, and I thought, maybe there's a connection. And so I got drawn into that whole subject of these Amazing Bodies of Nazca Peru, and I followed that and bugged Jaime from time to time to find out what was going on. And finally, in 2019, I went down to Peru because the bodies had finally landed in a university environment where they were protected, and there was a conference there. And
they were covered with some kind of material, weren't they?
Yes. The bodies, both species, had been covered with a diatomaceous earth. It's a white powder, which is actually diatoms, ancient diatoms. And it's a great preservative because it has a lot of sharp edges. And so if ants or bugs crawl across it, it gets into their joints, and they get locked up, and then they just get dehydrated and die. So it's a great, great way to preserve things. In fact, I know I used to sprinkle it around the foundation of my house.
That's right.
Yeah. So they were covered with that, maybe mixed with some kind of oil. I don't know. But the interesting thing is they weren't really mummies because they had all their organs, complete with all their organs. The two different species, Maria was the larger one, had some severe damage done to her buttocks. And they think that she had been attacked by like a large cat, whether what kind of cat, they don't know, but I mean, a very large cat.
Is that how she died, do you think?
Yes, they think so because there was kind of a pool of blood around her body. If you look at photographs of her, and I have them in both my science fiction book, The Alien Log 4, and in my new edition of The Science Behind, I dedicated a whole chapter to that subject because I think it's so important. I have personally believed that what we've seen is evidence of an alien that came to this earth. And so I thought, well, I really want to show people that. And so I was given permission to show some of the computer tomography images of the bodies. And it's because one of the big concerns when Jaime had announced that and they launched this investigation, it was, oh, well, they're just fake, you know. Some expert dermatologist, I mean, a taxidermist, had constructed these bodies. So they went to a great effort to show that it was impossible that these were manufactured bodies. And when you look at the computer tomography images, it's very clear these are real bodies.
I mean, clearly non-human.
Non-human. Maria looks the most human. She's about the height of an average woman, and she looks very much like a female except for her tridactyl fingers and toes, very long fingers and toes. Other than that, you would think she was human, and she has been DNA compared with the database. About 25% of her is human or human-like. The other species, which only are about 2 feet tall, don't match anything in the database. And they're bipedal, just like Maria. They're both bipedal species, but they're both tridactyl. The smaller species appears to be more reptilian. And the more I look into it, the more I can relate them to a frog because their skeleton structure is similar to a frog's. They have their skin kind of resembles that of a reptile.
Do you hear that buzzing sound coming out of your phone?
I do, yes.
We may have to call you back in a second if that continues.
Okay. Yeah, I've been hearing that. Now, I have to say I'm talking on a vintage phone here with a rotary dial on it.
Do you have like a backup phone or a cell phone?
Oh yeah, my cell phone. Yeah.
Because that's getting to be almost unacceptable here. So let's see. It seems to have gone away a little bit.
Don't know what it is.
No, it's not. That's probably Danny fixing it.
By the way, I just so you know, I'm in Israel, so that may be one of the problems.
That could be. Well, it seems to have gone away for a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
But we're going to have to...
It's
going to come back again.
Yeah, I do have my backup phone with me, and it seems to work fine.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold. Give Tom your backup number, if you would. Tom, grab that phone and get his backup cell phone number and call him back, and we'll try to get that. Sorry about the buzz, folks. Sorry about the buzz, folks. To be sure, that was not good at all. If we end up losing him, we do what we always do here, and that's go to open lines at Coast to Coast. So if you want to start with your phone calls, go ahead. The lines are now open just in case, because we've still got 2 hours to go here on Coast to Coast. So let's we'll figure out what happens if we don't get him. But We'll take your calls. We'll start open lines. And if we can get him back on, we will do our best we can. But it seems like every time we get involved in something controversial or strange, something always happens with their phones. It always just disappears, to be sure, like that. So that's not much. But anyways, we'll open up the phone lines right now, and we'll do some open lines for you. And then we'll see if we get Robert Farrell back on track on his backup phone and pick up what's going on. And I'm going to take you cold, folks. Welcome to the show. You're on.
Hey, this is Ron from Santa Barbara.
Hi there. Thanks for calling in.
Right, Joe. You know, you were talking about the spraying, the chem spray, and, you know, born and raised in Santa Barbara and very alert to it. Cal Poly up there in San Luis Obispo, they actually did a really good documentary called Look Up, all about it. And that was probably a little over 5 years ago. But, you know, I don't know how much they wiped off the internet or even YouTube. But there used to be a ton of information on YouTube that they've been deleting. I was on with Susie about 2 weeks ago. We were talking about the big skulls and how the gentleman's skull disappeared from Nevada. And I'm all, gee, my buddy's got one buried at Santa Rosa Island that no one will ever find, but he found one. But then we found out there was 15 of them in Catalina Island. With all the bones to meet this, you know, double row chief, this, that, all the excavation photos. It was all on YouTube and Google. And I told the guy, I'm all, well, but I bet it's going to be gone by tomorrow afternoon, you know, if yours disappeared. Now I Google it, it's not even on the stupid thing.
Yep, that happens. It happens very, very quickly. Let's go to another call. Welcome to the program. You're on.
Hello.
Hi there. What's up?
Hey, George. It's Brian from Washington.
Hey, Bri. Good to hear from you.
Hey, I was almost through to talk to Matthew on your last program tonight.
Right.
And my phone did the exact same thing. And I have, you know, speaking of 5G phones, I have a 5G phone, and it did the same thing that just happened. I think Tommy's ears was ringing just as bad as mine were, and I had all the radios turned off, my walkie-talkies and that, so I just think it's something in the air tonight.
All right, interesting. I think you're right. There's something really weird. Robert is back with us. Robert, I think we got you.
Good. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, so far so good. We'll see what happens. New phone or what?
You got me?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Anyways, we were talking about all things strange and these strange little entities, and clearly in your book,
The
pictures are remarkable. They do not look human at all.
They do not. And the other thing, you know, it's only been recently in my lifetime that I actually did some research on frogs to find out more about them. And I didn't know it, but maybe most people do. Frogs can breathe underwater. They actually transpire through their skin. But they, when they're on land, they also have lungs, but they don't have a diaphragm. But they use their throat to draw in air and then force it into their lungs. So they can breathe on land or underwater. Now, these bodies of the smaller species don't appear to have clear indication of a digestive system or lungs. And again, I get back to the frogs. And in my science fiction book, they describe themselves as getting their energy by soaking in a vat of fluid. And the thing is, in my research with people who have been abducted and reading about people who have been abducted, I recall from time to time I run across this idea that these abductees have reported that these rays don't eat. They actually immerse themselves in a fluid to get their energy. So these little two-foot guys really, in my mind, are one form of the grays that people see when they encounter UFOs. And but you don't hear much about it. That's the thing. That's why I thought, well, I should put it in my books. Maybe the public should find out more about it.
Are you convinced that governments are holding back from what we know?
Oh, yes. Yes, and I can't blame them. I mean, if I were the government, there'd be a number of reasons, you know, why I wouldn't want you to know about this. And that's why, after all these years and all these different committees and, you know, Blue Book and all that, They've always tried to hide the truth. And so the question one might ask, well, why wouldn't the government just come clean, you know? But there's a number of reasons why they may not want to do that. For one thing, right after World War II, the excuse was, well, they can't take the truth because they have these war nerves. They're jittery, you know, they're jittery from the war. And if you tell them, oh, by the way, there's aliens and they have technology that we can't defend against, they would panic. So that was one excuse for governments to kind of keep it hidden. But more recently, I think there's another one, and that is if it turns out that people find out about these and the fact that these UFOs can do the things that they really do, and that they don't have to have an energy source because they can draw energy from the free energy vacuum of space, it's going to be disruptive because we have a whole segment of society based on energy, you know, the oil industry and whatever, electricity generation, all that. That would be very disruptive if suddenly we had that opportunity to just have free energy. The other thing, these photographs that were taken by the Navy back in 2004 and the encounters they've had, and it was one experience where they were following these Tic Tacs, and one of them came right up to one of the lead planes. Excuse me. And he said that just about when he got up in front of him, he just disappeared. But yet, 6 seconds later, that same UFO appeared on a radar screen 60 miles away. So I did a quick calculation.
That's amazing speed.
Well, and to the pilot, it just disappeared. But I did a quick calculation, and I think it accelerated at about 1,000 Gs. They can do that.
Now, a human could not handle that.
That's true. It would not register in your brain. It would just suddenly not be there. And so if we are offered that kind of technology, I'm going to want it because I spend 14 hours getting over here to Innsbruck, and I would much rather spend 14 minutes, which I think I could do if we had that technology.
Well, you know, they're talking about supersonic flights that get us from Los Angeles to New York in a couple hours or something like that. And all that's conceivable, but you have looked at the propulsion system of alien technology, and they're doing something different, aren't they?
Exactly. When I first got interested in that, in the subject matter, the reports that the maneuvers that these craft could do, I say, well, they couldn't have any living bodies in it because it'd be squashed when they do 100 G acceleration or right angle turns. And so I did more research, and it turns out I think the best answer that explains all the things that people see them do is that they are actually producing a gravitational field. It's not anti-gravity. Anti-gravity would imply that they can only operate inside a gravitational field. Excuse me. They are actually producing gravity, and not only a gravity, but a negative field, because that fits the data. And what I did was actually just list all the things that people see them doing. You know, you lay out the evidence, because I have not been able to actually put my hands on a pile of UFO wreckage. All I have is what people report, and over the years, there's been thousands of reported sightings.
Well, hold on for a second, Robert. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back with more with Robert Farrell as we talk about his work, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. We'll take your calls next hour here on Coast to Coast. And welcome back. George Norrie with you, along with Robert Farrell, The Science Behind Alien Encounters. Robert, what do you think our religious people will do if and when governments start to disclose about the UFO existence? Well, how do you think they're going to tell us, the flock?
Well, my experience when I talk to people who are very religious is they think it's the work of the devil. And my fear is that when the disclosure occurs and the UFOs land on the White House lawn, I think it won't be good for some of the groups of religions where in the past some groups have actually committed suicide.
That's true. They have.
Yeah, and in fact, that's why I think I'm doing what I'm doing and out there trying to prepare people so it's not a shock, so that they don't jump off the cliff. And one of the only group that I know of religiously that's actively been trying to prepare its flock is the Catholic Church. Monsignor Balducci, the late Monsignor Balducci, I think was on a mission to do just that. He was on Rome Radio a number of times talking about the possibility that there's other life out there, that are humans. And then in 2005, I saw him speak at the Disclosure Conference outside of Washington. And again, he was the keynote speaker. So I think the Catholic Church is trying to prepare people for that. The other ones, I don't know, and I think they need to step in and really start explaining, you know, the fact that there's other life on other planets is not excluded by the Bible, and we just need to take a different interpretation, perhaps, of what's written in the Bible. Because otherwise, I think for some groups, it will be quite a shock, and we have to prepare them for that. That's what I've been doing, I think, for number of years now.
Well, what the Catholic Church started doing too is they were telling people the belief in extraterrestrial life does not negate one's belief in God. They were kind of like paving the way that there's something coming.
That's right. Exactly.
Now, you have talked about the gravitational fields and the propulsion systems and how these UFOs are. How did you come to this understanding?
Well, you know, when you're trying to analyze something, you get all the data you can, you lay it out. And as I pointed out earlier, I didn't have the ability to actually put my hands on a crashed UFO. But the evidence that's out there, and there's a lot of it, is through the testimony of people who've seen them do things. And so what I did is I just wrote down all the things that they can do. For instance, high G maneuvers is top of the list. They've been seen doing right angle turns. They can do supersonic speed without producing a shockwave. They can even travel through water at very high speed. When they're around metallic objects, sometimes they move them, you know, like in the Close Encounter of the Third Kind, if you recall, the mailboxes started moving. They can do that.
Mm-hmm.
They can change color. There's a whole list of things that they can do, and I wrote out that list, and I said, well, now, what's the best hypothesis for this? And gravity, being able to produce a gravitational field solves all of that.
Now, did they have to have some kind of special apparatus within the craft to be able to do this, or are they tapping into something else?
No, I think they actually do this. According to Einstein's general field theory, there's a possibility that there's an interaction between electric fields, magnetic fields, and gravitational fields. And throughout our history and technology, we've been playing around with the connection between electric and magnetic fields. And just recently now, the last couple decades, people have been playing around with the connection between electric and gravitational fields and also magnetic and gravitational fields. And the theory says that there should be a possibility of creating a gravitational field by manipulating electromagnetic fields. And in fact, the fact that light, which is an electromagnetic field, is bent when it passes through a gravitational field, and that's called gravitational lensing. And astronomers use that all the time. My reasoning is if gravity can affect electromagnetic fields, then why can't you do the reverse? And so I believe they are creating a gravitational field by manipulating either electric or magnetic or both fields to actually create a gravitational field. And in fact, I believe it's a negative field, which is something we don't have too much experience with. But some of the witness testimony on what they've seen these things do would say that it's probably a negative field. For instance, there's a photograph I've seen where a UFO is just taking off. It's about one diameter off the ground, and it's picking up dust. And it's very easy to see a clear spot underneath the craft. And so if you visualize that there's a negative field pushing the craft up, at the same time, it's pushing everything else down. It's expelling air underneath it, causing a low pressure region, and expelling the dust. So that's kind of an indication there's a negative field under the craft. There's also an incident, at least once, where people have come across an area, a shallow pond, where they had just seen a UFO hovering, and the pond is frozen. And it happens to be it's not freezing weather, you know, it's normal weather. So how did it freeze the pond? Well, again, if you have a negative field under the craft as it hovers, it will expel air, in other words, create a low pressure zone under the craft. And if you know, if you expose a water to low pressure, it starts evaporating very fast, maybe even boiling. And as those molecules are leaving the pond, they're taking energy with them, and so the rest of the pond is getting colder and colder and colder, and eventually it freezes. So those are some of the things that point to the fact that they actually are using a negative field. Another example would be how they can go supersonic speeds without creating a shock. So we can't do that because we rely on the pressure that's building up in front of the craft when we fly through the air. The faster we go, the higher the pressure. And I think of that, it's kind of like a signal up ahead for the molecules to get out of the way. We're coming. But that can only work up to the speed of sound. And at that point, you can't warn them, and you get a crash into you, and you get the shockwave. Well, if you could warn them by some other methods, like a negative field that's not limited to the speed of sound, these molecules can start getting out of the way sooner, and you don't have a shockwave. And in fact, that same principle can be used if you decide you want to dive into the water. Well, you just jump into the water. You know, you bring your craft into the water, and it expels the water around you. So you can travel underwater just as easily as you can travel in the air. So this is all evidence for a negative field. And the evidence for gravity field in general is the fact that they can do high G maneuvers that would kill people.
Oh, yeah. Anything. There's no way a human being could handle that.
Right. But if you have a gravitational field propulsion, there's a lot of benefits to that, one of which is not only is the craft being accelerated, but everything in it is accelerating. In my lecture, I give a thought experiment, you might say, and I have a volunteer from the audience agree to go into this nose cone of a B-2 rocket, and I give him a cell phone, and I light the fuse, and off they go. So we're talking back and forth. And I say, well, now, how's it going? And they say, well, I'm being held down on my couch by 4 Gs. My G meter says it's 4 Gs. So I'm watching, and all of a sudden the flame sputters out, but the rocket keeps coasting upward. And I ask them, well, now what's happening? And they say, well, my G meter says 0 Gs, and I'm tending to float in my cockpit. And I'm watching, and now the craft is falling. And I call back and I say, what's happening now? Oh, nothing's changed. I'm still floating in the cabinet, and the G meter says 0. I said, well, no, actually, you're accelerating at 1 G. And if we did this experiment on Jupiter, you'd be accelerating at 40 Gs, but you're free falling. So if you have gravity field propulsion, one of the big advantages is you can accelerate at any rate you want because you simply free fall either into that field or, in the case of a negative field, you free fall away from it. So that's just one of the advantages of that. The other is, with field propulsion, you don't have to carry thousands and thousands of pounds of fuel that you can throw out the back end to create thrust. You don't need that. You don't need that at all. Just you and the craft that need to be accelerated. And you can go on and on and on for hours and hours and hours. You don't ever run out of fuel. So if you want to get out of the solar system, you're not going to do it with chemical rockets. You got to have gravitational field propulsion. And being able to accelerate at high Gs for an extended period of time, 100 Gs, 1,000 Gs, whatever you want, will allow you to get up to very high velocities very quickly. And as you approach the speed of light, of course, you get time dilation.
So if you wanted to go to the nearest star, which is 4 light years away, and you accelerate fast enough, you might, according to a calendar on your craft, might say, well, this only took a day. And so you take a look. There's the star. Yeah, that's great. Let's go home. So you turn around and go back home. Well, that was only 2 days. When you land, the whole world is 8 years ahead of you. You just did time travel.
Interesting take. Now, I had a call during Open Lines last Friday, Robert, from someone who asked an interesting question. And he said, if these UFOs don't really want to be known or seen, why are they always lit up? How do you answer that?
Yes, well, that all is a function of how they are creating the gravitational field. A friend of mine, he's passed away, unfortunately, but he and a colleague presented a peer-reviewed paper at a propulsion conference at a multi-discipline like AIAA, Aeronautical Institutes, but it was a peer-reviewed paper and by a number of group of engineering people. Okay, I'm an engineer, so engineers are okay. But anyway, what they were proposing is that if you were to beam a high-frequency electromagnetic wave between two parallel plates that are highly reflective, and if you could have the right frequency or the right wavelength, as these photons are bouncing back and forth, when they strike the surface, they actually get converted into, if you're talking particle theory, they'd be converted into gravitons. And so you begin radiating gravitons, which actually propel you through space. That's how you get your propulsion, your field propulsion. It's gravitons that were created by beaming this electromagnetic energy between parallel plates. However, it's not 100% efficient. And so if your craft is just hovering, you don't have a lot of waste energy, because the waste energy is released in the form of infrared in one case, but the craft actually starts glowing. And if it's hovering, it's hardly glowing at all. But when it decides to accelerate, now it's really kicking in the juice there, and it starts glowing brighter and brighter because it's accelerating. So that's just a fact that the process they're using to create the gravitational fields is not 100% efficient. There is some waste energy that is expelled in the form of light, and the faster they're accelerating, the brighter the light.
Why aren't they interacting with us, though?
well, for one thing, would you, if you were out there,
no,
and observing us for thousands of years and saw us annihilate 60 million people, would you do that? Probably not. That's a good reason. But there's a couple other reasons. One is that...
Well, what do they want then, Robert? If they're not interacting with us, what do they want, in your opinion?
I think they're overseeing the planet. You know, maybe they would assign this as a project.
Well, if Sitchin was correct and they seeded us, then we're basically their offspring, right?
Well, I believe he's right. There's a lot of evidence for that we are genetically attached to whatever aliens, Anunnaki in this case, that created us. But so they would have a reason, maybe because they have an interest in us, maybe they love us. And some people call them the Watchers. And so they're watching over the planet. And in my science fiction book, there's a conversation between a human and an alien as to, you know, the aliens saying, well, you know, we've watched, first of all, aliens can live as long as they want. So a 1,000-year project is nothing for them. So they're watching over the Earth. And so the human says, well, didn't that disturb you when you saw us have a war? And the alien said, well, you know, it did. But we kind of have a directive not to interfere. And whenever we come across the planet that has a developing life form, we're not supposed to interfere. They just have to work it out. It's like parents when their kids are fighting. They have two kids that are fighting. You kind of have to let them work it out. And so that's as much as it hurts them to see that, I think, they just felt that they had to be hands off.
Well, yeah, but as a parent, you step in.
At some point, you step in, and I think that's where we are now. I think when we set off the first nuclear bomb, that raised somebody's interest in, hey, wait a second. They're reaching a point where not only could they destroy each other, but they can destroy the whole planet, and we can't let that happen. And as you are aware, and your audience, I'm sure, is aware of the number of incidents in which UFOs have appeared over
missile silos. Yeah. Well, they've shut them down. Sure.
Or just shut them down. Yeah, exactly. So they don't want us to play with the nuclear weapons. That's quite clear. And now are screwing up the environment so much that we are very close, perhaps maybe in my lifetime or certainly in my grandson's lifetime, of experiencing the sixth extinction of life on this planet, because our technology, we are raising the CO2 level. We go, like, I think it's gone from 0.03% up to 4% in my lifetime. And we can't go much higher before we reach a tipping point where the planet heats up to the point where all this methane that's now been frozen basically down in the ocean bottom it's very sensitive to the temperature of the water, and eventually it starts bubbling up as methane, which is like 20 times worse than CO2.
Oh, that's true. Hold on, Robert. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and chat a little bit more about all this incredible stuff that you've been working on. Robert Farrell with us, the science behind alien encounters.